Hello everyone, my name is Elijah David. This is the 12th Hour Apostolic Sabbatarian Congregation. I was on at the 12th Hour in the Liberty Hill, Texas. Today is March 7, 2017, or 09, 2020. We will start our first service today with a song entitled Leaning on the Everlasting Arms. For a fellowship, what a joy divine, leaning on the everlasting arm. What a blessedness, what a peace is mine, leaning on the everlasting arm. Leaning, leaning, safe and secure from all alarm. Leaning on the everlasting heart. Oh, how sweet to walk in this pilgrim way, leaning on the everlasting heart. Oh, how bright the breath grows from day to day, leaning on the everlasting heart. Leaning, leaning, safe and secure from all alarm. Leaning, leaning, leaning on the everlasting heart. What have I to dread? What have I to fear? Leaning on the everlasting heart. I have blessed peace with my yesterday, leaning on the everlasting heart. Leaning, leaning, safe and secure from all alarm. Part 6, Abraham and Canaan, Patriarchs and Prophets, from page 132, chapter 12. Abraham returned to Canaan very rich in cattle, in silver and in gold. Lot was still with him, and again they came to Bethel and pitched their tents by the altar which they had before erected. They soon found that increased possession brought in increased trouble. In the midst of the hardships and trials, they had dwelt together in harmony, but in their prosperity there was danger of strife between them. The pasturage was not sufficient for the flocks and herds of both, and the frequent disputes among the herdsmen were brought for settlement to their masters. It was evident that they must separate. Abraham was Lot's senior in years, and his superior in relation in wealth and in possession. Yet he was the first to propose plans for preserving peace, although the whole land had been given him by Elohim himself. He courteously waived his right. "Let there be no strife," he said, "between me and thee, and between my herdmen and thy herdmen, for we be brethren. Is not the whole land before thee? Separate thyself, I pray thee, from me. If thou wilt take the left hand, then I will go to the right. Or if thou depart to the right hand, then I will go to the left." Here the noble, unselfish spirit of Abraham was displayed. How many under similar circumstances would at all hazards cling to their individual rights and preferences? How many households have thus been rent asunder? How many churches have been divided, making the cause of the truth a byword and a reproach among the wicked? Let there be no strife between me and thee, said Abraham. For we be brethren, not only by the natural relationship, but as worshipers of the true Yahweh, the children of the Yahweh, the world over, are one family, and the same spirit of the love and conciliation should govern them. Be kindly affectioned one to another, with brotherly love, and honor, preferring one another, is the teaching of our Savior. The cultivation of a uniform courtesy, a willingness to do unto others as we would wish them to do unto us, would annihilate half the ills of the life. The spirit of self-aggrandizement is the spirit of Satan, but the heart in which the love of Yahshua is cherished will possess that charity which seeketh not her own. Such will heed the divine injunction. Look not every man on his own things, but every man also on the things of others. Although Lot owed his prosperity to his connection with Abraham, he manifested no gratitude unto his benefactor. Courtesy would have dictated that he yield the choice unto Abraham, but instead of this, he selfishly endeavored to grasp all its advantages. He lifted up his eyes and beheld all the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere. Even as the garden of the Yahweh, like the land of Egypt, as thou comest unto Zoar, the most fertile region in all Palestine was the Jordan Valley, reminding the beholders of the lost paradise and equaling the beauty and productiveness of the now enriched plains they had so lately left. There were cities also wealthy and beautiful, inviting to profitable traffic and their crowded marts. Dazzled with the visions of worldly gain, Lot overlooked the moral and spiritual evils that would be encountered there. The inhabitants of the plain were sinners before the Yahweh exceedingly, but of this he was ignorant, or knowing, gave it but little weight. He chose him all the plain of Jordan and pitched his tent towards Sodom. How little did he foresee the terrible result of that selfish choice. After separation from Lot, Abraham again received from the Yahweh a promise of the whole country. Soon after this, he removed to Hebron, pitching his tent under the oaks of Mamre, and erecting beside it an altar to the Yahweh. In the free air of those upland plains, with their olive groves and vineyards, their fields of waving grain, and the wide pasture grounds of the encircling hills, he dwelt, well content with his simple, patriarchal life, and leaving to Lot the perilous luxury of the Vale of Sodom. Abraham was honored by the surrounding nations as a mighty prince and a wise and able chief. He did not shut away his influence from his neighbors, his life and character, in their marked contrast under those of the worshippers of the idols, exerted a telling influence in favor of the true faith. His allegiance unto Yahweh was unswerving, while his affability and benevolence inspired confidence and friendship, and his unaffected greatness commanded respect and honor. His religion was not held as a precious treasure to be jealously guarded, and enjoyed solely by their possessor. True religion cannot be thus held, for such a spirit is contrary to the principles of the gospel. While Yahshua is dwelling in the heart, it is impossible to conceal the light of his presence, or for that light to grow dim. On the contrary, it will grow brighter and brighter as day by day, amidst the selfishness and sin that envelop the soul are dispelled by the bright beams of the Sun of Righteousness. For the people of Yahweh are his representatives upon the earth, and he intends that they shall be lights in the moral darkness of this world, scattered all over the country, in the towns, cities, and villages. They are Yahweh's witnesses, the channels through which he will communicate to an unbelieving world the knowledge of his will and the wonders of his grace. It is his plan that all who are partakers of the great salvation shall be missionaries for him. The piety of the Christian constitutes the standard by which worldlings judge the gospel. Trials patiently borne, blessings gratefully received, meekness, kindness, mercy, and love habitually exhibited are the lights that shine forth in the character. Before the world, revealing the contrast with the darkness that comes and the selfishness of the natural heart. Rich in faith, noble in generosity, unfaltering in the obedience, and humble in the simplicity of his pilgrim life, Abraham was also wise in diplomacy, and brave and skillful in war. Notwithstanding, he was known as a teacher of a new religion. Three royal brothers, rulers of the Amorite plain in which he dwelt, manifested their friendship by inviting him to enter into an alliance with them for greater security, for the country was filled with violence and oppression. An occasion soon arose for him to avail himself of this alliance. Chedorlaomer, a king of Elam, had invaded Canaan 14 years before and made it tributary to him. Several of the princes now revolted, and the Elamite king, with four allies, again marched into the country to reduce them to submission. Five kings of Canaan joined their fortress and met the invaders in the Vale of Siddim, but only to be completely overthrown. A large part of the army was cut to pieces, and those who escaped fled for safety to the mountains. The victors plundered the cities of the plains and departed with rich spoil and many captives, among whom were Lot and his family. Abraham, dwelling in peace in the oak groves at Mamre, learned from one of the fugitives the story of the battle and the calamity that had befallen his nephew. He had cherished no unkind memory of Lot's ingratitude. All his affection for him was awakened, and he determined that he should be rescued. Seeking first of all divine counsel, Abraham prepared for war. From his own encampment, he summoned 318 trained servants, men trained in the fear of Yahweh, in the service of their master, and in the practice of arms. His confederates, Mamre, Eshcol, and Aner, joined him with their bands, and together they started pursuit of the invaders. The Elamites and their allies had encamped at Dan, on the northern border of Canaan. Flushed with victory and having no fear of an assault from their vanquished foes, they had given themselves up to reveling. The patriarch divided his foe so as to approach from different directions and came upon the encampment by night. His attack, so vigorous and unexpected, resulted in speedy victory. the king of Elam was slain, and his panic-stricken forces were utterly routed. Lot and his family, with all the prisoners and their goods, were recovered, and a rich booty fell into the hands of the victors. And Abraham, under Yahweh, the triumph was due. To Abraham, under Yahweh, the triumph was due. The worshiper of Yahweh had not only rendered a great service to the country, but had proved himself a man of valor. It was seen that righteousness is not cowardice, and that Abraham's religion made him courageous in maintaining the right and defending the oppressed. His heroic act gave him a widespread influence among the surrounding tribes. On his return, the king of Sodom came out with his retinue to honor the conqueror. He bade him take the goods, begging only that the prisoners should be restored. By the usage of war, the spoils belonged to the conquerors, but Abraham had undertaken this expedition with no purpose of gain, and refused to take advantage of the unfortunate, only stipulating that his confederates should receive the portion to which they were entitled. Few, if subjected to such a test, would have shown themselves as noble as did Abraham. Few would have resisted the temptation to secure so rich a booty. His example is a rebuke to self-seeking mercenary spirit. Abraham regarded the claims of justice and humanity. His conduct illustrates the inspired maxim, "Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself." "I have lifted up mine hand," he said, "and to Yahweh, the Most High Yahweh, the possessor of heaven and earth, that I will not take from a thread, even to a shoe lashed, and that I will not take anything that is thine, lest thou shouldst say, I have made Abraham rich." He would give them no occasion to think that he had engaged and warfare for the sake of gain, or to attribute his prosperity to their gifts or favor. Yahweh had promised to bless Abraham, and unto him the glory should be ascribed. Another who came out to welcome the victorious patriarch was Melchizedek, king of Salem, who brought forth bread and wine for the refreshments of his army. As priest of the Most High Yahweh, he pronounced a blessing upon Abraham and gave thanks unto Yahweh, who had wrought so great a deliverance by his servant, and Abraham gave him tithes of all. Abraham gladly returned unto his tents and his flocks, but his mind was disturbed by the harassing thoughts. He had been a man of the peace, so far as possible shunning enmity and strife, and with horror he recalled the scene of carnage he had witnessed. But the nations whose forces he had defeated would doubtless renew the invasion of Canaan and make him the special object of their vengeance. Becoming thus involved in the national quarrels, the peaceful quiet of his life would be broken. Furthermore, he had not entered upon the possession of Canaan, nor could he now hope for an heir unto whom the promise might be fulfilled. In a vision of the night, the divine voice was again heard. "Fear not, Abraham," were the words of the prince of princes. "I am thy shield and thy exceeding great reward." But his mind was so oppressed by the foreboding that he could not now grasp the promise with unquestioning confidence as heretofore. He prayed for some tangible evidence that he would be fulfilled. And how was the covenant promise to be realized while the gift of a son was withheld? What will thou give me, he said, seeing I go childless? And lo, one born in my house is mine heir. He proposed to make his trusty servant Eleazar his son by adoption and the inheritor of his possession. But he was assured that a child of his own was to be his heir. Then he was led outside his tent and told to look up to the unnumbered stars, glittering in the heavens, and as he did so, the words were spoken, "So shall thy seed be." Abraham believed Yahweh, and it was counted unto him for righteousness. Still the patriarch begged for some visible token as a confirmation of his faith, and as an evidence to after generation that Yahweh's gracious purposes told them would be accomplished. Yahweh condescended to enter into a covenant with his servant, employing such forms as were customary among men for the ratification of a solemn engagement. By the divine direction, Abraham sacrificed a heifer, a she-goat, and a ram, each 3 years old, dividing the bodies and laying the pieces a little distance apart. To these, he added a turtle dove and a young pigeon, which, however, were not divided. This being done, he reverently passed between the parts of the sacrifice, making a solemn vow to Yahweh of perpetual obedience. Watching and steadfast, he remained beside the carcasses till the going down of the sun, to guard them from being defiled or devoured by the birds of prey. About sunset, he sank into a deep sleep, and lo, a horror of a great darkness fell upon him, and the voice of Yahweh was heard, bidding him not to expect immediate possession of the promised land, and pointing forward to the sufferings of his posterity before their establishment in Canaan. The plan of redemption was here open unto him. In the death of Yahshua, the great sacrifice and his coming in glory, Abraham saw also the earth restored to its Eden beauty, to be given him for an everlasting possession as the final and complete fulfillment of the promise. As a pledge of this covenant of Yahweh with men, a smoking furnace and a burning lamp, symbols of the divine presence, passed between the severed victims, totally consuming them. And again a voice was heard by Abraham, confirming the gift of the land of Canaan unto his descendants, from the river of Egypt unto the great river, the river Euphrates. When Abraham had been nearly 25 years in Canaan, Yahweh appeared unto him and said, "I am the Yahweh Elohim, walk before me and be thou perfect." And all the patriarch fell upon his face, and the message continued, "Behold, my covenant is with thee, and thou shalt be a father of many nations." And in token of the fulfillment of this covenant, his name, heretofore called Abraham, was changed to Abram. Abraham, which signifies father of a great multitude. Sarai's name became Sarah. Princess, for said the divine voice, "She shall be a mother of nations. Kings of people shall be of her." At this time, the rite of circumcision was given to Abraham as a seal of the righteousness of the faith, for she had yet been uncircumcised, it was to be observed by the patriarch and his descendants as a token that they were devoted to the service of Yahweh and thus separated from idolaters, and that Yahweh accepted them as his peculiar treasure. Okay, by this rite, they were pledged to fulfill on their part the conditions of the covenant made with the Abraham. They were not to contract marriages with the heathen, for by so doing, they would lose their reverence for Yahweh and his holy law. They would be tempted to engage in the sinful practices of other nations and would be seduced into idolatry. Yahweh conferred great honor upon Abraham. Angels of heaven walked and talked with him as friend and friend. When judgments were about to be visited upon Sodom, the fact was not hidden from him, and he became an intercessor with Yahweh for sinners. His interview with the angels presents also a beautiful example of the hospitality. In the hot summer, noontide, the patriarch was sitting in his tent door, looking out over the quiet landscape, when he saw in the distance three travelers approaching. Before reaching his tent, the strangers halted as if consulting as to their course without waiting for them to solicit favors. Abraham rose quickly, and as they were apparently returning in another direction, he hastened after them and with the utmost courtesy urged them to honor him by tearing for refreshment. With his own hands, he brought water that they might wash the dust of travel from their feet. He himself selected their food, and while they were at rest under the cooling shade, an entertainment was made ready, and he stood respectfully beside them while they partake of his hospitality. The act of courtesy Yahweh regarded as sufficient importance to record in his word. And 1,000 years later, it was referred to by an inspired apostle. Be not forgetful to entertain strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unawares. Abraham had seen in his guest only three tired wayfarers, little thinking that among them was one whom he might worship without sin. But the true character of the heavenly messengers was now revealed. Though they were on their way as ministers of wrath, yet to Abraham, the man of faith, they spoke first of blessing. Though Elohim is strict to mark iniquity and to punish transgression, he takes no delight in vengeance. The work of the destruction is a strange work unto him who is infinite in love. The secret of the Yahweh is with them that fear him. Abraham had honored Yahweh, and the Yahweh honored him, taking him into his counsel and revealing unto him his purposes. Shall I hide from Abraham that thing which I do, said the Yahweh. The cry of Sodom and Gomorrah is great and become their, because their sin is very grievous. I will go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the cry of it, which has come unto me. And if not, I will know. Yahweh knew well the measure of sin. So Yahweh knew well the measure of Sodom's guilt. But he expressed himself after the manner of men, that the justice of his dealings might be understood. Before bringing judgment upon the transgressors, he would go himself to institute an examination of their course. if they had not passed the limits of the divine mercy, he would still grant them space for repentance. Two of the heavenly messengers departed, leaving Abraham alone with him whom he now knew to be the son of Yahweh, and a man of faith pleaded for the inhabitants of Sodom. Once he had saved them by his sword, now he endeavored to save them by prayer. Lot and his household were still dwellers there, and the unselfish love that prompted Abraham to their rescue from the Elamites now sought to save them, if it were Yahweh's will, from the storm of the divine judgment. With deep reverence and humility he urged his plea, "I have taken upon me to speak unto Yahweh, which am but dust and ashes." There was no self-confidence, no boasting of his own righteousness. He did not claim favor on the ground of his obedience or of the sacrifices he had made in doing Elohim's will. Himself a sinner, he pleaded in the sinner's behalf. Such a spirit all who approach Elohim should possess. Yet Abraham manifested the confidence of a child pleading with his loved father. He came close to the heavenly messenger and fervently urged his petition. Though Lot had become a traveler, a dweller in Sodom, he did not partake in the iniquity of his inhabitants. Abraham thought that in that populous city there must be other worshippers of the true Yahweh, and in a view of this he pleaded, "That be far from thee to do after this manner, to slay the righteous with the wicked. That be far from thee. Shall not the judge of all the earth be right?" Abraham asked not once merely, but many times, waxing bolder as his requests were granted. He continued until he gained the assurance that if 10 righteous persons could be found in it, the city would be spared. Love for perishing souls inspired Abraham's prayer. While he loathed the sins of that corrupt city, he desired that the sinners might be saved. His deep interest for Sodom shows the anxiety that we should feel for the impenitent. We should cherish hatred of sin, but pity and love for the sinner. All around us are souls going down to ruin as hopeless, as terrible as that which befell Sodom. Every day the probation of some is closing. Every hour some are passing beyond the reach of mercy. And where are the voices of the warning and entreaty to bid the sinner flee from his fearful doom? Where are the hands stretched out to draw him back from death? Where are those who will, with humility and persevering faith, are pleading with Yahweh for him? The spirit of Abraham or the spirit of the Yahshua, the son of Yahweh and himself, the great intercessor in the sinner's behalf, he who has paid the price for its redemption, knows the worth of the human soul. With an antagonism to evil such as can exist only in a nature spotlessly pure, Yahshua manifested toward the sinner a love which an infinite goodness alone could conceive. In the agonies of the crucifixion himself, burdened with the awful weight of the sins of the whole world, he prayed for his revilers and murderers, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." Of Abraham it is written that he was called the friend of Yahweh, the father of all them that believe. The testimony of Yahweh concerning this faithful patriarch is, "Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws." And again, "I know him that he will command his children and his household after him, and they shall keep the way of the Yahweh to do justice and judgment, that the Yahweh may bring upon Abraham that which he hath spoken of him. It was a high honor, and to which Abraham was called, that being the father of the people who for centuries were the guardians and preservers of the truth of Yahweh for the world, of that people through whom all the nations of the earth should be blessed in the advent of the promised Messiah. But he who called the patriarchs judged him worthy. It is Yahweh that speaks. He who understands the thoughts afar off and places the right estimate upon men says, I know him. There would be on the part of Abraham no betraying of the truth for the selfish purposes. He would keep the law and deal justly and righteously. And he would not only fear the Yahweh himself, but would cultivate religion in his home. He would instruct his family in righteousness. The law of Elohim would be the rule in his household. Abraham's household comprised more than 1,000 souls. They were led by his teachings to worship the one Elohim found a home in his encampment, and here, as in his school, they received such instruction and would prepare them to be representatives of the true faith. Thus, a great responsibility rested upon him. He was training heads of families, and of methods of government would be carried out into the household over which they should preside. In the early times, the father was the ruler and the priest of his own family, and he exercised authority over his children, even after they had families of their own. His descendants were taught to look up to him as their head in both religious and secular matters. This patriarchal system of government Abraham endeavored to perpetuate as it tended to preserve the knowledge of Yahweh. It was necessary to bind the members of the household together in order to build up a barrier against the idolatry that had become so widespread and so deep-seated. Abraham sought by every means in his power to guard the inmates of his encampment against mingling with the heathen and witnessing their idolatrous practices, for he knew that familiarity with evil would insensibly corrupt the principles. The greatest care were exercised to shut out every form of false religion and to impress the mind with the majesty and glory of the living Elohim as the true object of worship. It was a wise arrangement which Elohim himself had made to cut off his people as so far as possible from connection with the heathen, making them a people dwelling alone and not reckoned among the nations. He had separated Abraham from his idolatrous kindred, that the patriarch might train and educate his family apart from the seductive influence which would have surrounded them in Mesopotamia, and that the true faith might be preserved in its purity by his descendants from generation to generation. Abraham's affection for his children and his household led him to guard their religious faith, to impart unto them a knowledge of the divine statutes as a most precious legacy he could transmit to them and through them to the world. All were taught that they were under the rule of the Elohim of heaven, There was to be no oppression on the part of parents, and no disobedience on the part of children. Yahweh's law had appointed to each his duties, and only in obedience to it would any secure happiness or prosperity. His own example, the solid influence of his daily life, was a constant lesson. The unswerving integrity, the benevolence, and unselfish courtesy, which had won the admiration of kings, were displayed in the home. There was a fragrance about the life, a nobility and loveliness of the character, which revealed unto all that he was connected with heaven. He did not neglect the soul of the humble servant. In his household there was not one law for the master and another for the servant. A royal way for the rich and another for the poor. All were treated with justice and compassion as inheritors with him of the grace of life. He will command his household. There would be no sinful neglect to restrain the evil propensities of his children, no weak, unwise, indulgent favoritism, no yielding of his conviction of the duty unto the claims of the mistaken affection. Abraham would not only give right instruction, but he would maintain the authority of just and righteous laws. How few there are in our day who follow this example. On the part of too many parents, there is a blind and selfish sentimentalism, miscalled love, which is manifested in leaving children with their uniform judgment and undisciplined passion to the control of their own will. Okay, it says, this is the very cruelest of the youth and a great wrong to the world. Parental indulgence causes disorders in families and in society. It confirms in the young the desire to follow inclination instead of submitting unto the divine requirement. Thus they grow up with a heart adverse to doing Elohim's will, and they transmit their irreligious insubordinate spirit to their children and children's children. Like Abraham, parents should command their household after them. Obedience and the parental authority be taught and enforced as a first step in obedience to the authority of Yahweh. The light esteem in which the law of Yahweh is held, even by the religious leaders, has been productive of great evil. The teaching, which has become so widespread that the divine statutes are no longer binding upon men, and the same is the same as idolatry and its effect upon the morals of the people. Those who seek to lessen the claims of Yahweh's holy law are striking directly at the foundation of the government of families and nations. Religion, the religious parents are failing to walk in his statutes, do not command their household to keep the way of Yahweh. The law of Yahweh has not made the rule of life. The children, as they make homes of their own, feel under no obligation to teach their children what they themselves have never been taught. And this is why there are so many godless families. This is why depravity is so deep and widespread. Not until parents themselves walk in the law of Yahweh with the perfect hearts will they be prepared to command their children after them. A reformation in this respect is needed. It says a reformation which shall be deep and broad. Parents need to reform. Ministers need to reform. They need Yahweh in their household. If they would see a different state of things, they must bring His word into their families. Must make it their counselor. They must teach their children that it is the voice of Yahweh addressed to them and is to be implicitly obeyed. They should patiently instruct their children, kindly and untiringly teach them how to live in order to please Yahweh. The children of such household, are prepared to meet the sophistries of infidelity. They have accepted the Bible as the basis of their faith, and they have a foundation that cannot be swept away by the incoming tide of skepticism. In too many households, prayer is neglected. Parents feel that they have no time for the morning and evening worship. They cannot spare a few moments to be spent in the thanksgiving to Yahweh for His abundant mercies, for the blessed sunshine and the showers of the rain, which cause vegetation to flourish, and for the guardianship of the holy angels. They have no time to offer prayer for the divine help and guidance, and for the abiding presence of the Yahshua in the household. They go forth to labor as the ox on the horse goes without one thought of Yahweh or heaven. They have souls so precious that rather than permit them to be hopelessly lost, the Son of Yahweh gave His life to ransom them, but they have little appreciation for His great goodness. Then have the beasts of that perish. Like the patriarchs of old, those who profess to love Yahweh should erect an altar to the Yahweh wherever they pitch their tent. And if there was a time when every house should be a house of prayer, it is now. Fathers and mothers should often lift up their hearts unto Yahweh in humble supplication for themselves and their children. Let the father, as the priest of the household, lay upon the altar of Yahweh the morning and evening sacrifice, while the wife and the children unite in prayer and praise. In such a household, Yahshua will love to tarry. From every Christian house, a holy light should shine forth. Love should be revealed in action. It should flow out in all home. Intercourse, showing itself a thoughtful kindness and a gentle, unselfish courtesy. There are homes where this principle is carried out. Houses where Elohim is worshipped and truest love reigns from those homes. Morning and evening prayer ascends to Yahweh as sweet incense, and His mercies and blessing descends upon the suppliant like the morning dew. A well-ordered Christian household is a powerful argument in the favor of the reality of the Christian religion, an argument that the infidel cannot gainsay. All can see that there is an influence at work in the family that affects the children, and that the Elohim of Abraham is with them. If the homes of the professed Christians had a right religious mold, they would exert a mighty influence for good. They would indeed be the light of the world. The God, Yahweh of heaven, speaks to every faithful parent in the words of the address to Abraham. I know him, that he will command his children and his household after him, and they shall keep the way of the Yahweh to do justice and judgment, that the Yahweh may bring upon Abraham that which he has spoken of him. End of chapter 12, chapter 13, the test of faith. Abraham had accepted without question the promise of a son, but he did not wait for Yahweh to fulfill his word in his own time. A delay was permitted to test his faith in the power of the Yahweh, but he failed to endure the trial, thinking it was impossible that a child should be given her in her old age. Sarah suggested as a plan by which the divine purpose might be fulfilled, that one of her handmaidens, should be taken from Abraham as a secondary wife. Polygamy had become so widespread that it had ceased to be regarded as a sin, but it was no less a violation of the law of Yahweh, and was fatal to the sacredness and peace of the family relation. Abraham's marriage with Hagar resulted in evil, not only to his own household, but by the future generation. Flattered with the honor of her new position as Abraham's wife, and hoping to be the mother of the great nation to descend from him, Hagar became proud and boastful and treated her mistress with contempt. Mutual jealousies disturbed the peace of the once happy home. Forced to listen to the complaints of both, Abraham vainly endeavored to restore harmony. Though it was at Sarah's earnest entreaty that he had married Hagar, she now reproached him as the one at fault. She desired to banish her rival, but Abraham refused to permit this, for Hagar was to be the mother of his child, as he fondly hoped, the son of promise. She was Sarah's servant, however, and he still left her to be the control of her mistress. Hagar's haughty spirit would not brook the harshness with her insolence, which her insolence had provoked. When Sarai dealt hardly with her, she fled from her face. She made her way to the desert, and as she rested beside a fountain, lonely and friendless, an angel of Yahweh in a human form appeared unto her, addressing her as Hagar, Sarai's maid. To remind her of her position and her duty, he bade her, "Return to thy mistress and submit thyself under her hand. Yet with the reproof, there were meaningful words of comfort. The Yahweh hath heard thy affliction. I will multiply thy seed exceedingly, that it shall not be numbered for multitude. And as a perpetual reminder of his mercy, she was bidden to call her child Ishmael. Yahweh shall hear." When Abraham was nearly 100 years old, the promise of a son was repeated unto him, with the assurance that the future heir should be the child of Sarah. But Abraham did not yet understand the promise. His mind at once turned to Ishmael, clinging to the belief that through him, Elohim's gracious purposes were to be accomplished. In his affection for his son, he exclaimed, "Oh, that Ishmael might live before thee." Again, the promise was given in words that should not be mistaken. Sarah, thy wife, shall bear thee a son indeed, and thou shalt call his name Isaac. And I will establish my covenant with him. Yet Yahweh was not unmindful of the father's prayer. As for Ishmael, he said, "I have heard thee. Behold, I have blessed him, and I will make him a great nation." In this study, we're going to close now with a song entitled "Work for the Night is Coming." Work for the night is coming. Work through the morning hour. Work while the dew is sparkling. Work mid springing flowers. Work while the day grows brighter under the glowing sun. Work for the night is coming when man's work is done. Work for the night is coming. Work through the sunny noon. Till brightest hours with labor, rest comes sure and soon. Give every flying minute something to keep in store. Work for the night is coming when man works no more. Work for the night is coming under the sunset sky. While their pretense of glowing, work for daylight flies. Work till the last beam faded to shine no more. Work while the night is darkening, when man's work is o'er.